planes burn fossil fuels, and so the first thing is they're putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere that wasn't there before. And so carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, so we get heating of the planet because of that. Overall, somewhere between 2-3% of the global warming that we're currently experiencing is, you know, can be attributed to flying. But flying's actually slightly worse than, say, the carbon dioxide that comes out of your exhaust pipe when you're driving to work, because of the emissions taking place at altitude. Now, it doesn't really matter where on the planet you emit carbon dioxide, because the carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere for, you know, hundreds of years, so it's going to stay warming for a long time. But there's some short-lived gases, nitrogen oxides. They only last for about a day, typically, in the atmosphere. So if you emit them at altitude, you can do more harm with them. And they will actually interact with oxygen and form ozone, which is another greenhouse gas. Also, the contrails, you know, so they're clouds, essentially, that are seeded by planes, ice crystals that form in the upper atmosphere, and they actually contribute to global warming as well. And there's a possibility, and this is, there's still a fair bit of scientific uncertainty around this, that some of the, just the soot particles that get emitted from the exhaust of the jet engine actually maybe go on to seed clouds, and that might contribute to global warming as well. So there's a number of different ways in which flying is bad for the planet. And one other question that often comes up when I'm talking to people is, you know, flying, it's only the 3%. And so why should we look at flying in particular? You know, there's all sorts of other things that we could prioritise over that. And I think one of the reasons that flying is kind of something you should look at first, particularly if you're a frequent flyer, is it's actually one of the few things that's within your control as an individual. Most of the battle against climate, you know, it involves big policy decisions. Are we going to build another coal-fired power station, for example? And those are decisions that politicians and corporations are making. There are not many decisions that you make that you have complete control over, and flying is one of those things. So it's a way that you can actually take action personally. And while, you know, you're not going to save the world by doing it, it actually sends a signal to other people that actually you're serious about climate change. And I think, you know, once we start to act en masse and we start to make these individual decisions, that's going to put a lot of pressure on politicians and corporations. They'll start noticing that we're prepared to act on climate, and they'll start adjusting their decisions accordingly.
So you've undertaken some research around this, and I understand you've written a book about your year of not flying.
Yep.
Tell us about that. What journey did you go on, and how did you avoid flying for the year?
Yeah. So I, you know, I'm a scientist and I travel a lot for my work. So, you know, 2017, I flew 84,000 kilometres, you know, a couple of times to Australia. I think I even went to Adelaide at one point. And so I realised that actually, you know, although overall flying is only about, you know, 3% of the impact on the climate, for me, it was about 3/4 of my carbon footprint was coming from flying. And I thought, wow, gosh, that's a bit hypocritical, right? I'm telling people that we need to be serious about global warming, we need to reduce our carbon footprint, you know, and then I jump on a plane and fly off somewhere else. So I wanted to do something about that, and I thought, well, I'll challenge myself to stay off planes for a year. And, yeah, I mean, it meant I didn't go overseas. I didn't do what Greta Thunberg did and fail anywhere. But I did. I stayed on the ground, and I used trains quite a bit. The New Zealand rail network, it's fairly decrepit, but it's still possible to get between the major centres using trains, and you can get other places using buses. So I did that. And then actually there are a few electric vehicle car sharing companies that have sprung up in New Zealand in the last 18 months. So actually I was able to use those to get to a few more out-of-the-way places. Yeah, so staying on the ground and all up, I reckon I saved about 18 tonnes of carbon dioxide through doing that.
Wow, that sounds like a lot. But how did you actually go about determining your personal carbon footprint?
Yeah, so it's actually quite difficult to do. I mean, there's a bunch of reasons that make it difficult. I mean, obviously you can sort of, you know, if you know how much petrol you burnt or how much jet fuel you burnt, then you can, you know, you can actually calculate how much carbon dioxide is emitted from that. But then you get into things like, well, you know, you're on a plane, you're sharing that plane with a couple of hundred people, you know, do you divide that by the number of people on that plane? You know, should people in business class, should you give them a higher attribution, you know, for that carbon? So there's a whole lot of things that you have to do to estimate how much you've actually emitted. And then there's the obvious one is actually by staying off the plane still flew, right? This is something I had to confront. But just because I didn't take the plane, you know, the plane still went from Auckland to Wellington, you know, or from Auckland to Adelaide. So actually, was I actually making a difference at all? And that's partly why I wrote the book, because what I had to do was persuade a couple hundred other people to do the same. If a couple hundred people decide not to take that flight over the year, you know, reduce demand on the airlines, then actually I am saving that carbon. And so that's why I've written a book, and I've done quite a lot of media about this. And also I used the hashtag NoFly during the year on social media so that I could actually show people what I was doing and actually persuade them that it might be a good idea not to emit as much through flying.
So you mentioned there you were travelling, for example, between Auckland and Wellington. And there's been lots of talk in Australia about a high-speed rail network between Sydney and Melbourne, which is currently about the same distance, I think, between Auckland and Wellington. Do you think we should be supporting infrastructure like this to sort of avoid the emissions that you're talking about there?
Yeah, I do think so. You know, we're investing in airports, right? I know this happens in Australia as well, and in New Zealand we're putting more money into airports, and we're anticipating growth in airline passengers, but actually we're not taking into account the damage from carbon dioxide emissions. And we know that, you know, by at least in New Zealand by 2050 we've committed to being carbon neutral, and we won't be able to do that if we increase the number of flights we're taking. So, yeah, investing in infrastructure like rail is actually crucial. You know, we're making these decisions to invest in air infrastructure, and actually we should instead be making investments in rail and low-emissions infrastructure. And so that's quite an important thing to do. I mean, there are other things that airlines can do to reduce their impact. I mean, one is offsetting. So that's where you may be, you know, you can tick a box when you buy your airline ticket. And, you know, that puts a little surcharge on your ticket, and that goes to planting trees, for example. And those trees will take some of the carbon dioxide back out of the air. You know, that can mitigate some of the damage, but it's a little bit problematic, especially in New Zealand. We just haven't got the land area to plant the trees that we'd need to offset our flying. So we can't do it all through offsetting. You know, there's biofuel. But, you know, that's competing with food production. That's not a realistic option. We may reduce some of the fossil fuel emissions through biofuel, but it's not going to be 100%. And then people are talking about electric planes, but they're going to be very, at least in the next couple of decades, we may see them, but they're going to be very short hop, more like air taxis rather than planes that will take you between, say, Sydney and Melbourne. So really, there's, you know, we don't have good technological fixes for flying. So, yeah, we do need to be investing in infrastructure that will take people off planes and keep them on the ground.
So what are the best alternatives? You mentioned sort of low emissions transport. What are the best options?
Yeah, it'll depend what you've got available to you. And, you know, I mean, New Zealand's energy mix is quite different to Australia. So New Zealand's, we've got a very high proportion of renewables. About 80-85% of our electricity generation is renewable. So we've got pretty good options around electrified trains. They're actually very, very good from a carbon perspective. But even, you know, if you're taking public transport, you're taking a bus, that's going to beat flying. So even if it's a diesel bus, you know, you're going to be better off taking that bus rather than flying. But obviously, if you've got an electric train, then that's going to win out over the bus. Electric vehicles too. You know, we can't get everywhere through public transport, and you know, there's a variety of reasons why public transport options might not be the right ones for you. So electric vehicles can be good as well. I mean, in New Zealand, they're, again, particularly good because our electrical grid is very high on renewables. But even in Australia, you do have more coal and gas-fired power plants than we do. And, you know, an electric vehicle over the long run will still actually be better than flying, potentially. You know, that's if you can take the time. There's some quite long distances to drive in Australia, of course.
I guess that's a challenge, is time, because the distance of train travel between Sydney and Melbourne, for example, is around 11 hours, and yet a flight might be an hour and a half, 2 hours tops, sort of thing. Yep. So how do you convince people or encourage people to not take the faster option?
Yeah, I mean, so that is a challenge, right? It's something I had to come to grips with a little bit during my year of not flying, right? I'm just going to take a day basically to sit on a train. And I mean, what I found actually was I was really comfortable working on the train. So it was a bit like an office with a view for the day. And so once I was able to work around that and get quite a bit of work done on the train. You know, it won't suit, depends on what your job is. But for me as an academic, you know, with my laptop, I can work pretty independently on a train. And the other thing is, it's just the way you plan your travel. And this can apply whether you're flying or taking the train. I actually eliminated quite a few trips. You know, and it's partly because I was having to take that 11-hour, right? So I didn't want to do a quick turnaround. Once I'd taken the 11-hour train between Auckland and Wellington, I actually wanted to stay longer. I didn't want to immediately get back onto the train. So what I was doing is staying for a week in Wellington. And effectively, through planning, I was able to replace 5 day trips with a single week down in Wellington. And that works whether you're flying or taking the train. If you're just able to combine as much into that one trip, and eliminate the day trips that you might otherwise take, then you can actually save quite a bit of carbon. So through good planning, yeah, you can make that work for you. And actually, when I added the time up, you know, you're on the train for 11 hours, they tend to be more reliable, you know, this is what I found over the year, than flying. I mean, you often don't think of it, but your plane's often, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes late. And then you've got to get in and out of the airport, and that's not easy in some of the big cities. And so actually, when I added it up, if I spent 11 hours on the train there and back, so 22 hours, if I replaced that with my 5 day trips down on the plane, I was actually spending slightly less time travelling, taking the train than I did when I was taking planes and being delayed and having to get in and out of the airport.
Yeah, it's interesting. Working a bit smarter, saving that time there.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, you do need other people to cooperate. So other people need to understand what you're up to. I mean, I did have probably my worst experience was our Minister of Education was supposed to be making an announcement in Wellington. And to get to that announcement, I had to take an overnight bus. Now, this is my least favourite option. You know, they're not particularly comfortable. And, of course, the buses tend to throw you around, particularly on New Zealand roads, right, when you're going through the mountains. They can be a bit uncomfortable. And then I got there only to find that the minister had decided not to make the announcement that day. So I was sleep deprived and grumpy, and there was nothing for me to do because I'd rushed down to this particular event. So yeah, not basing your decisions on whether you think a minister's going to make an announcement or not is probably a good idea. And then, you know, I had a meeting that was in the South Island of New Zealand, actually a really beautiful part of New Zealand, in Nelson. And I thought this was going to be great. I'll plan this big trip. I'll get down to Nelson. I'll do all these other things on the way down to Nelson. And then about a week before that Nelson meeting, I was just about to leave, and the meeting was moved from Nelson back up to Auckland. And so I found myself on an overnight bus again, trying to get back to this meeting in Auckland. So again, you know, if people around you are willing to be a bit more predictable and not sort of make these last-minute decisions about meetings, then you can plan and you can reduce your carbon footprint that way.
So flying is a huge part of tourism. So when people are planning their holidays and things like that, what suggestions would you have for them that, you know, they want to take an overseas trip, but flying might not be the best environmentally? What would you suggest?
Yeah, look, if you've got to consider your options. I mean, you know, obviously with, you know, New Zealanders and Australians, we're quite multicultural societies, you know, so a lot of us will have relatives overseas that we might want to visit. It's pretty hard to say to people, you know, you're not going to be able to take the grandchild back to meet its grandparents back home. So we do have to accept that some travels like that is going to have to happen. And so if you've got to make the trip, if it's really a trip that you really want to make, then think about offsetting. And, you know, and it can, you can do this in a variety of ways. You can tick the box on your airline ticket. I mean, although those schemes are not particularly transparent, so it's often hard to know what you're getting. Or you could get involved in some native habitat restoration. I mean, in New Zealand, you know, we have a lot of activities in restoring native bush, and it'll be similar in Australia. Something like helping restore your local wetlands. Actually, wetlands are an amazing carbon sink. So even just going in and doing some planting, you know, helping with that restoration of habitat for native species can actually do a lot of good to the environment. It can take carbon out of the atmosphere and, you know, undo some of the damage that you might have done through your trip. So I encourage people to think about that. First of all, you know, do think about whether that trip's really necessary. You know, is there anything else you could do instead for the holiday? Is there another place you could go that, you know, you don't necessarily have to fly to? Or, you know, if it's something that you really want to do, if you, you know, involves seeing relatives or a part of the world you really want to get to see, you know, then think seriously about offsets and what you can do to undo that damage.
Absolutely. Now, 2018 was your no-fly year.
Yeah.
I'm guessing then you've taken some flights this year. What have you learned along the way?
Yeah, so, I mean, I've realised I really don't like air travel. I think when I was travelling before, it kind of felt a little bit glamorous, you know, and there's the sort of the excitement of going new places. But actually, having avoided airports for a year, I really did not enjoy going back into airports. So that was the first thing I learned, is actually air travel's not very pleasant, you know, giving it up. And it actually took going cold turkey for a while for me to realise how much I wasn't enjoying it. Going back into air travel this year as well, you know, I've learned tricks such as the one I mentioned, where instead of doing a day trip to Wellington, I'll combine a bunch of days into one. So I'm still taking the plane down, but in fact, I'm reducing the total number of flights. So I'm reducing my carbon footprint that way. You know, I think the other thing is just realising, you know, how important it is to go see your family. So my wife is from Canada, and so in 2018 we didn't go back to visit her parents, and so this year we did. And, you know, it's pretty hard to say no, you're never going to go and see your family again and completely cut out flying. So part of coming back into this year is acknowledging that actually there are very human reasons why we're going to fly. You know, we've spread ourselves out over the world, our family relationships and the people we love are spread out because we've had the ability to fly, and it's really hard to undo that. And so it's not about completely cutting flying out, but it's about being more mindful of the trips that you're taking and whether you really need to take those trips.